Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Vic Fingerhut, political polling and media consultant, who discusses the urgent need for President Obama to aggressively address the U.S. unemployment crisis. Eric Bollert of Media Matters for America, who takes a critical look at the corporate press corps' coverage of the often contentious and divisive health care reform debate. And Rashid Khalidi, professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University, who examines the split within the Palestinian movement between Fatah and Hamas and the prospects for restarting peace negotiations with Israel. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
7 years ago, Rachel Corrie, a young American activist, was killed when she was run over by an Israeli military bulldozer in the occupied Gaza Strip. Now her parents have filed a civil lawsuit against Israeli authorities. Corrie, a volunteer with the pro-Palestinian International Solidarity Movement, or ISM, knelt in front of an army bulldozer to prevent a Palestinian home from being demolished in Rafah, which borders Egypt. According to witnesses, Corrie stood up in full view of the soldier driving the bulldozer prior to her being run over. According to the Christian Science Monitor, an Israeli army investigation acquitted the military of any responsibility in Corrie's death. The report concluded the soldier driving the tank did not see the 23-year-old ISM activist, who at the time was wearing a bright orange jacket. The civil trial, which began on March the 10th, comes as Israel's relations with the Obama administration have become strained over the expansion of Jewish settlements on Palestinian land. At the beginning of the trial, the Corrie family issued a statement which said, "We hope this trial will illustrate the need for accountability in the thousands of lives lost by occupation." With water levels along the Mekong River in Southeast Asia at their lowest levels in 50 years, China is coming under fire for causing the crisis. Eco-activists say China is the culprit because it has built a series of 8 dams on the upper reaches of the Mekong, depleting water levels in downstream countries like Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, and Vietnam. Villagers in these downstream countries have lost their livelihoods due to failing levels of fish to catch. According to the Interpress service, China has initiated a rare public defense against the growing criticism. Chinese officials blame the low water levels on a severe drought in the region and not its dams along the Mekong River. Chinese diplomat Chen Dihai claims the upper reaches of the Mekong, known locally as the Lankang River, only accounts for 14% of the total river discharge reaching the South China Sea. Concern over China's dam building on the Mekong grew after the first dam came online in the early 1990s. Green activists in Thailand saw a drop-off in river water levels and a decline in fish stocks, the staple diet for 60 million people in Southeast Asia. The worldwide scandal of child sex abuse by Catholic priests has shaken the Vatican and implicated Pope Benedict. As Archbishop in Munich in the early 1980s and in the Vatican in the mid-1990s, the Pope, then known as Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, is being charged with failing to take action against parish priests who sexually abuse young boys. Some are calling for his resignation. In 1980, Father Peter Hallermann, who by 1986 would be convicted of being a pedophile, was sent to Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger's diocese for therapy. However, only after a few days, Hallermann was assigned to pastoral duties. In the mid-1990s, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone ordered the church trial halted of Reverend Lawrence Murphy in Wisconsin, accused of molesting as many as 200 deaf boys after Murphy wrote Ratzinger a letter saying he was ill, infirmed, and, quote, "simply want to live out the time that I have left in the dignity of my priesthood." The independent newspaper The National Catholic Reporter has called for a full inquiry at the Vatican into how Pope Benedict may have mishandled sex abuse cases which date back 30 years in his days in Munich. According to the BBC, active sexual abuse cases are being investigated in 18 of the 27 Catholic dioceses in Germany. Abuse allegations have also been brought against the Pope's brother, Reverend George Ratzinger, who ran a choir for nearly 30 years. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
The most urgent issue for the majority of Americans today is record-high unemployment, triggered by an economic downturn not seen since the depths of the Great Depression. Although the official unemployment rate in March stood at 9.7%, many economists agree that the real unemployment rate is closer to 16.8%, a figure that includes those jobless workers who have given up looking for work and part-time workers who are continuing to seek full-time positions. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, more than 40% of the nation's 14.9 million unemployed workers have been out of a job for 27 weeks or longer. While the unemployment rate may dip slightly in the next month or so, and some indicators such as consumer confidence are inching up, there is general agreement that the nation should expect only a slow and painful recovery. The bad economy has stoked anger at Washington, both Democrats and Republicans, which is easily seen in public opinion polls that finds both parties with low approval ratings, an anti-incumbent sentiment which leads many voters to say, throw all the bums out. After winning congressional approval for his $787 billion stimulus package in February 2009, President Obama has been reluctant to pump substantial amounts of money into the jobless economy, fearing that the Republicans will use the escalating deficit to make political gains in the 2010 midterm elections. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Vic Fingerhut, a political polling and media consultant who worked for the presidential campaigns of Democrats Hubert Humphrey and Walter Mondale. He discusses the urgent need for President Obama to aggressively address the U.S. unemployment crisis or face a voter backlash in the November 2010 congressional elections.
I hate to say this, as someone who worked very hard to help elect Barack Obama as president, I think the administration has not moved aggressively enough on the jobs front. I mean, I think one can make a case that had not the original stimulus package passed, I think unemployment could have gone up to 12, 13, 14%. The official rate and the unofficial rate could have gone over 20%. You know, and that's fine. From a public policy standpoint, I think the initial stimulus bill probably did avert pushing us back into a 1930s version of, you know, of economic collapse. But having said that, and I think it's very clear from polls, Americans, you know, and say, well, that's not enough. We got millions of people out of work. It's been over a year now. We're pushing 2 years. There are projections now that we won't be down to 5 or 6% unemployment until 2, 3, 4 years down the road. And frankly, I think for many Americans and for millions and millions of Americans, that's simply unacceptable. But in the Obama administration, he had the good and bad fortune to have the election in November 2008 while the economy was in free fall. Well, that helped him win the election. But in a very real sense, it left an ambiguous legacy about whose recession and depression it was. And so for the first year, 2009, he said, well, it's Bush's fault, and we inherited all this from Bush. And to some degree, the polls indicated people kind of bought that. Well, by the time you moved into the late months in 2009, that explanation was beginning to wear pretty thin. And it was particularly beginning to wear pretty thin among just working people, but including people who had been the base of the Democratic Party vote. I mean, I, for example, people like sheet metal workers. They had unemployment levels now by December of 2009 of 30 to 35%. Here was a group of workers in the building trades, largely white, but who stuck by the Democratic Party and delivered over 70% of their membership in the 2008 elections for Obama. And here they're sitting around at 35, 30, 35% unemployment. In the same months, in November and December of 2009, they're reading reports about the huge amount of the companies that the financial institutions that had received multi-billion-dollar bailouts from the government, and all of a sudden these folks are rolling in huge profits and huge bonuses for their top people. And all of a sudden, I think, for millions of Americans, and Roosevelt is quite relevant here, because Roosevelt created the Democratic majority in the 1930s. Prior to that, this country had been largely Republican since the Civil War. But all of a sudden, for the first time since the 1930s, millions of American working people started saying, well, is the Democratic Party really the party of American working people? And once that question is raised, and if it's answered in a negative sense, the Democrats may lose 70 years, something that took them seven decades to build and provided the basis of their enduring political strength.
What is the scope and breadth of the jobs program that you think is essential for the economy and essential politically for Obama and the Democrats?
Well, I mean, I'm a political scientist, and that's my focus, right? Not an economist. I mean, I listen to these economists and see what they say. First of all, I think whatever it is has to be massive, there are all kinds of things. I mean, the administration has shied away from massive public programs, what we did in the 1930s. Well, my own view is I don't see any reason to shy away from that. I think, you talk about $20, $30 billion programs, and, I've talked to members of the Senate, people like Harkin and stuff, and they recognize that that's a drop in the bucket. I mean, compared, if you're going to run a stimulus program to get millions of people back to work, you're talking about $200, $300, $400, $500 billion in spending. So, well, boy, look at all that spending. Where are we going to get it? Well, we're going to get it back in productivity. I mean, if you go back to the 30s and 40s, Roosevelt was running $2, $3, $4 billion a year deficits. And at least he prevented at one point, unemployment was 20-25%, and the line was heading straight down. And Roosevelt, in many respects, kind of straightened the line up and, cut back unemployment a little bit. But basically, it wasn't until World War II that we had and that's when we ran up these huge deficits. And we got unemployment back to 3-4%. As long as you have people unemployed, you're not going to have the generation of taxes. The GDP isn't going to grow as fast. The productive resources of the United States are not going to be used. And to see American resources lying idle, to me, is just nutty.
That was Vic Fingerhut, a political polling and media consultant. Read his article, Obama and the State of Democrats, online at inthesetimes.com. In the recently concluded congressional debate over health care reform legislation, emotions ran high. The name-calling, the scare tactics, and misinformation spread by opponents of virtually all reform measures was extremely effective in leading the public to be very fearful of what reform would mean for them and their own health insurance plans. AstroTurf groups, funded by corporate interests, took advantage of people's natural suspicion of change and created a media-savvy strategy of organizing small but loud protests at congressional town hall meetings last summer, which had a lasting impact on the debate. In the days leading up to passage of health care reform and President Obama signing the bill into law on March 23rd, right-wing Tea Party activists, encouraged by some of their allies in the Republican Party, let loose with a barrage of insults, racial slurs, and dozens of death threats targeting congressional Democrats who voted for the measure. The FBI and local police also investigated a number of acts of vandalism and violence directed at pro-reform Democrats' offices and homes. Now that the dust is beginning to settle in the health care debate, some media outlets for the first time are working to separate fact from fiction about what the new health reform law will mean to individual citizens and their families. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Eric Bollert, a senior fellow with Media Matters for America, who examines the corporate press corps' performance in covering the health care reform debate.
In terms of covering the rash and the outbreaks of violence and intimidation since the vote, I think the press did a pretty good job. It's a very important story that we're sort of in unprecedented territory here. We have insults being hurled at congressmen as they go into the chamber to vote. We have Democratic state offices being vandalized with bricks being thrown through the window. And make no mistake, there are notes on the bricks. This is not a mystery in terms of who's throwing the bricks. They come with messages attached, death threats, all kinds of crazy things. So this is new, and this is sort of unprecedented in modern American politics. And I think the press did a good job covering that. They treated it seriously, and they gave it a fair amount of attention. If we step back further in terms of the health care debate, and I chuckle because, you know, the Republican allegation last week and during the run-up to the vote was Democrats were cramming this through and they were rushing it through. And, of course, we've had this, quote, debate for about 13 months now, endless hearings. And my gosh, I mean, I think the Obama White House wanted this done by last November. So it's been a sort of this slow-motion debate. But, you know, I don't think the press did a particularly great job. I think they were obsessed with process, with vote counting, with the politics, and not particularly interested in the public policy. The irony was it was really after it became clear that the legislation was going to pass that that's when sort of a lot of the network news shows actually devoted a couple of chunks of minutes to explain what was in the bill. But in the months and in the year up to that, it was mostly process and politics.
Eric, what are some of the more blatant examples of the misinformation that was spread about what this health care would or would not do? And I say that, of course, for my own part, realizing that this health care reform package is not all that I wanted it
to
be.
Right.
And certainly not what many progressive activists around the country wanted it to
right.
be. It was like, if not even a half a loaf, maybe a quarter loaf.
That's right.
But certainly there were so many distortions that were repeated ad nauseum without challenge.
Yeah, well, I mean, just that point that you made, this is a very moderate bill in terms of what was really on the table. This is a much more moderate, trimmed-down version of health care that Obama probably ran on as a candidate. This gives all kinds of, everyone I think would agree, gives all sorts of concessions to, you know, the insurance companies, the pharmaceuticals, et cetera. So the rhetoric that this is socialism, that this is a communist document, that the government is taking over health care, that was probably one of the most egregious, and of course Fox News was the proud birther of that. So one of the biggest canards was this is some sort of anti-capitalist, you know, socialist document. The other big one that Fox News spread relentlessly, that it was just a massively expensive bill. You know, it was going to bust all of the sort of budget projections, and that this was effectively bankrupt America indefinitely.
Eric, I wanted to ask you about what kind of job the corporate media, the mainstream media, did in being a truth detector and not just repeating the talking points of the Tea Party guys and the extreme right-wing Republicans who were calling this health care reform bill modeled on Richard Nixon and Bob Dole's plan, both Republicans, that it was somehow going to be Armageddon. How'd they do it sorting through the truth from the lies?
On that front, I don't think they did a great job. I don't think they really engaged in a lot of that, you know, this is Marxist, this is socialist type of thing. So on that specific count, I guess they did okay. But in general, I don't think there's any doubt they let the Tea Party push them around. The Beltway press is always nervous and intimidated by the right wing, particularly when they target the press. So I think the Tea Party has been able to push, and particularly their attacks on health care reform. It started really last August with what I call these mini mobs at the town hall forums. I think the press absolutely, the Tea Party had the press absolutely eating out of their hands. You know, a couple hundred people show up and yell and scream, and the press literally overnight decided that is Main Street America. We've never had such a tiny bout of activism be represented as the mainstream. So I think the corporate press sort of bowed down to the Tea Party as it attacked health care reform and has not done a particularly good job in pushing back at all.
That was Eric Bollert, senior fellow with Media Matters for America. He's the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. Read Bollert's articles online at MediaMatters.org. Tensions in the Middle East are again on the rise as the rift between Israel and the Obama administration continues over Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's refusal to halt settlement building in Arab East Jerusalem. Nonviolent protests have escalated in the West Bank, followed by a severe crackdown by Israeli occupation forces. Meanwhile, rockets fired from the Gaza Strip by a faction not affiliated with the ruling Hamas party recently killed a foreign worker in an Israeli border town, the first such death since the end of the Israeli invasion of Gaza in January 2009. Against this backdrop, Rashid Khalidi, a Palestinian scholar and the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University, spoke at the Yale Law School on March 25th. He addressed mostly the internal problems of the two major Palestinian political movements, Fatah and Hamas, which came into open conflict after Hamas won the 2006 Palestinian Authority legislative elections. Fighting erupted between the two groups in May 2007, which resulted in Hamas taking control of Gaza and Fatah governing the West Bank. In his talk, Khalidi examined the corruption of Fatah and the inflammatory anti-Israel rhetoric of Hamas, which he says presents major obstacles to any hope for the Palestinian people to achieve either a two-state or a one-state solution. The following excerpt of his hour-long talk examines the split between Palestinians and the prospect for restarting peace negotiations with Israel.
Hamas in 2005, 6, and 7 changed course and tacitly accepted both a two-state solution and the Oslo Accords by agreeing to take part in PA Legislative Council elections in 2008. It was accepting the Oslo rules that it had rejected from 1993. Hamas thereby put itself, in my view, in a completely contradictory and impossible position. On the one hand, it was critical of the meager results of Fatah's negotiations with Israel, it was critical of Fatah's scaling down of Palestinian national aspirations, and it was critical of Fatah abandoning any means of pressure on the Israeli side. On the other hand, Hamas has shown itself again and again willing to enter into a series of ceasefires with Israel, one of which is in force right now in the Gaza Strip, and after 2006 agreed to be part of coalition governments with Fatah that would negotiate with Israel. So what's the difference between Fatah and Hamas, in effect? Hamas thus seemed to be increasingly committed to its own peculiar form of a two-state solution, rejecting, of course, any formal recognition of Israel, but accepting the possibility of as much as a 100-year truce, Hudna, with Israel, and other similar features. Hamas thus seemed to want to preserve its purity, to retain its virginity, as it were, but to enjoy the fruits of sin. The need for a fresh approach to the definition of Palestinian national goals, the need for a reexamination of the means for achieving these goals is increasingly apparent. Anybody who tells you that Palestinians believe that armed struggle or resistance, whatever you describe it as, is the only way to liberate Palestine, and that that is a popular position amongst Palestinians, needs to have their head examined. That is, in fact, not the case. There's an enormous frustration when large numbers of Palestinians are killed, and there's a momentary support for any kind of retaliatory action, any kind of vindictive action, any kind of striking out that causes Israelis to suffer, civilians or not. But over time, if you look at the numbers, over time, if you look at the politics of Palestinian nationalism, it's clear that there's an understanding that this is a fundamentally flawed approach. This includes a rethinking of the appropriate forms of resistance to occupation, and also a rethinking of the unwillingness of the Fatah-dominated PA in Ramallah to resist at all, and to sort of say, well, we'll get rid of the occupation when we negotiate the end of the occupation, but in the meantime, the bulldozers are building, and the roads are being built, and the walls are being built, and the settlements are being built. This includes rethinking the importance of nonviolent means, which are increasingly being used in some villages along the course of the wall, in some neighborhoods in Jerusalem that are being subject to incursions by settlers. in terms of the support for boycott and divestment and sanctions and the growing support for these things in Palestinian civil society. It's clear that there's thinking about this going on. And it finally includes the need to rethink whether it is possible in the current circumstances to negotiate an end to the occupation with Israel. And if so, what is the best approach to doing this and to achieving other Palestinian national objectives? You listen to the PA and they seem to think that negotiations are an end in themselves. How are you going to negotiate? How are you going to change the Israeli position? How are you going to change Israeli public opinion? How are you going to change American public opinion? Nobody in any Palestinian leadership position has an answer to these kinds of questions. Instead of addressing these kinds of questions, Fatah and Hamas have for years now been mired in a fratricidal conflict which just has its objective taking over an authority that has no sovereignty, no jurisdiction, and no real authority. They have been talking between Fatah and Hamas about unity for nearly a year and a half now. Given the bitterness that's developed, given the strong vested interests of external parties in the continuation of the existing inter-Palestinian divisions, given the obstacles that the United States in particular, but Israel as well, are capable of placing in the way of a PA unity government, I don't think the likelihood of these talks succeeding is great. A senior American government official said to me, if Fatah and Hamas agreed on a unity government, the United States would cut off $900 million immediately. Not out of any vindictiveness, because that's U.S. law. U.S. law bans giving money to any organization that's labeled a terrorist organization. Hamas is a terrorist organization. Any government that includes Hamas, by U.S. law, cannot receive U.S. funds. So the United States position is, in effect, a position which would prevent any kind of Palestinian national union. Even the creation of a government that would agree to negotiate would not meet these criteria. And even if the two sides do, by some miracle, manage to succeed, and some form of Palestinian unity is restored and a coalition government is formed and new elections are held, and these are a lot of ifs, folks. Even if the blockade of Gaza is lifted, even if reconstruction of Gaza, the parts of Gaza that were destroyed could begin, which it has not for over a year, the really hard part would be yet to come. This would involve getting the Palestinian people out of the unfavorable status quo that they had been in for many years, a status quo of occupation, of the dispersion of the Palestinians, and of the lack of a clear Palestinian strategy.
That was Rashid Khalidi, professor of modern Arab studies at Columbia University. He is the author of several books, including Sowing Crisis, The Cold War and American Dominance in the Middle East. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Toth. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.